All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. And our last guest today is Chris Emery. He's from the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what's new in the Oklahoma City bombing case?
Well, of course, we have the Nichols trial. They are in the middle of, in the process of starting the jury selection in McAllister. For the folks in your listening area that aren't familiar with McAllister, it's about a 2.5-hour drive southeast of Oklahoma City. It is home to the largest maximum security prison, state prison in the state. And that's where Terry Nichols has been transferred to, awaiting his trial, which is due to start, according to some of the defense attorneys that I've talked to, approximately April 1st. It's going to take a while to get the jury seated. So,
well, an April Fool's Day should be appropriate enough for this case, don't you think?
Yes, I never really thought of that. It is appropriate.
Well, for the people who have no idea what we're talking about, why is it appropriate?
Well, I think that it'll bring out, as you put it, the fools and that were exposed to a large extent in the federal trials in Denver for Terry Nichols and, of course, with the McVeigh trial. I just got off, and I don't think I told you this in our conversation we had a few days ago. I had the opportunity to talk to Terry's brother, James, who still lives in Decker, Michigan. And as he puts it, in the second most famous White House in the country, same farmhouse everyone saw on the CNN clip shortly after the bombing. And he said that he had kept in touch with some of the jury members that reluctantly convicted his brother on the charges that were presented by the prosecution in Denver. And they were just one vote shy of actually acquitting him of all charges. And so, you know, even the jury foreperson, Nikki Deutschman, and I watched her videotape 47-minute interview to the press right after the verdict was handed down. She said that the federal prosecution did such a lousy job of presenting the case that, like I said, they were within one vote of acquitting Mr. Nichols. That's how weak the case was against him. If that's the best that the federal prosecution could have presented at that time, you know, within 2 years of the bombing, they really have, the state has nothing really to stand on now. And in fact, it's a detriment to the state prosecution because a lot more has been come out and a lot more has been exposed and a lot of the truth has actually been revealed for what it truly is since that time.
Well, do you think that Terry Nichols is innocent or just that they didn't prove their case because they didn't want to bring up all the evidence that they had?
I think that he is not guilty of the charges of being the co-conspirator with McVeigh. There were definitely other people involved, and I am not siding on Terry Nichols' situation. What I'm trying to bring out is the fact that he should have not been sentenced to the severe time that he was given.
Right. And, well, and I have the clip of the jury forewoman that you talk of. I have a clip I'll play after this interview of her saying that the federal prosecution did not do a good job of proving that he had anything to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the newspapers at the time said that the original vote in the jury room was 10-2 for acquittal. And that the two men who wanted to convict bragged, and the quote was, "We made them cry," in order to get the other 10 to go along and convict him of involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah, it's an aberration and definitely a huge miscarriage of justice. And Mr. Nichols was definitely set up on some respects. I found out since then that one of the prosecutors, in fact, they've studied the case, Beth Wilkerson, in her final closing arguments was pushing the emotional side of the case. There was no fact. There was no hard evidence that was presented to the jury. And, you know, and I think you and I talked about this at some length when you first introduced yourself. This case is a classic example of how not to investigate a case of terrorism. In fact, it would be at the top of the list of a video if you ever were to put one together in a case study in any law school in the world, for that matter, of how you can methodically and with malice and forethought choose to completely run away from the truth and try a huge murder case on emotion. That's the way the Oklahoma City bombing trials, both of them, were conducted in Denver, and hopefully that won't be repeated in McAllister.
Okay, so if they convicted McVeigh and Nichols based on emotion, then what is the evidence?
Well, the evidence is the fact that the federal government, for a variety of reasons, that I'm still trying to put my finger on, destroyed evidence, obstructed justice, tampered with the just something as basic as the FBI 302 witness statements, completely turned around a lot of the statements that were made by witnesses, and methodically chose to completely run away from the facts of this case. And it, it's really, it's chilling when you, you review the reams of documents that I've had a chance to look at on behalf and thanks to the Oklahoma City Bombing Investigation Committee. And there's there, there's just so much that needs to be presented in the state trial, and it will come out, at least according to some of the defense attorneys that I've talked to.
Well, and it's got to be said that the defense attorneys aren't so much interested in the truth as they are in getting their guy off. So they're not going to want to tell the whole story if it includes Nichols.
It, you know, that's a good point to bring up. Charles Key and I drove down and talked to two of Nichols' attorneys a week ago Thursday in McAllister. We sat in the living room of the home of one of them, and of course they weren't at liberty to divulge their method, and we weren't really interested in that. What we did, and it was a very constructive conversation, we presented, Charles and I presented the information that we had uncovered since 1995, and in good faith presented it to the defense attorneys to say, look, you folks, you know, have the opportunity to present this, bring it before the judge. And in fact, Stephen Taylor is doing a very admirable job of trying to be objective on this. And with all due respect to Judge Mace, I think he's definitely gone three or four levels above in the effort to remain objective.
Stephen Taylor, he's the judge in the state case.
That is correct. He's okay. A district judge for the state of Oklahoma, and one of the finest, from what I understand.
So he seems already like he's going to be willing to let people testify that the FBI wouldn't necessarily prefer testify?
Absolutely. In fact, it's been proven many times. the local papers, the Independent, and some of the national media papers here have said that he has fought, and this has been reiterated by the defense attorneys, he's fought tooth and nail every step of the way, every single day, since the prosecution, both the state and the federal prosecutors, and if you could believe this, they're actually helping each other out, which is that's a whole discussion in and of itself. But he's fought them every step of the way in the effort to give the defense a fair chance on this, and that was not a favor that was afforded to the defense for McVeigh nor Nichols in Denver. So
that's a funny way of putting it, a favor, as
yeah.
though that wasn't mandated in the Constitution that allows this federal government to exist, that
yeah.
we must be able to have compulsory cross-examination of witnesses against us and compulsory
It would be great. In fact, I'd love to come down to Austin, and maybe we can, you know, do an extension of this conversation sometime, but the efforts of what the federal prosecution did, and I have absolutely no problem, Beth Wilkerson, you know, naming their names, Joseph Hartzler, Tom Mackey, and there were three or four others of the key prosecutors, and they had a huge team, I believe about 22 to 25 individuals. So it wasn't by accident they were choosing to do this stuff. Like I said, it was malice and forethought, and I say malice because you really can't describe it in any other way. One would, if one chooses to cover up the truth, to obstruct justice, to completely alter what is commonly, you know, recognized as factual information, you know, and you walk into the courtroom knowing this, where's the integrity on that? And then, you know, we can get into a conversation on that in, like I said, another time. But
well, and hey, I mean, obstruction of justice is a felony.
Absolutely. And there were so many counts of it. Perjury, obstruction of justice, like I said, witness tampering, just flat-out destruction of the crime scene. That should have never – that crime scene was destroyed on May 23rd, coincidentally the same day that James Nichols got out of federal prison in upstate Michigan. And he pointed it out to me. And I didn't realize that. But they should have kept that crime scene together at least until the end of July, if not mid-August, because there was so much forensic evidence in there that it could have pointed to – at least 10 other individuals that I've looked at that would point to 10 other people involved in this crime. So
and they admitted that they lied when they said that the building was going to fall. They had to take it down because it was too dangerous, because the structural engineers had said, oh no, we could brace this and that. We could even rebuild this very building. It
Absolutely.
Doesn't need to be destroyed at all.
Absolutely. In fact, three members of the committee talked to the architects that originally designed that building. It was designed in 1974. In fact, I have a partial set of the blueprints that I'm reviewing on some other parts of the case. And one of the partners talked to the committee and said two-thirds of that building was actually standing. The one third that everybody saw, the gaping hole, was above the ground. But a third was still remaining above the ground. The other third was actually underground, the parking ramp. And that was structurally sound. They had no business tearing that building down. It could have been repaired and rebuilt. So.
Okay, now the reason that this is all even in the news, I mean, people driving by are thinking, Oklahoma City, what the hell are they talking about? Don't they know September 11th has happened since then? And
sure.
This
sure.
is old news. So the reason that this is, I mean, besides just Terry Nichols' trial set to begin here in a month or so, is there's a New York Times story, a big story, three or four days ago, mm-hmm. about a guy named Deffenbaugh, who apparently was the FBI special agent in charge in that investigation.
Yes.
And he said, oh, no, wowee, I just got some brand new evidence that I've never seen or heard ever before, and this might be something that needs looking into. And now the FBI has ordered a review of the Oklahoma City bombing material, and so they're starting to, for the first time, they're starting to say, okay, well, maybe there were John Doe 2s and 3s and 4s here.
Well, they knew of these gentlemen, in fact, within 4 hours after the bombing. And I've talked to an investigator that used to work for the Tulsa Police Department. He was called by an FBI special agent in charge of the Tulsa office within 3 days.
That would be Bob Ricks, correct?
Mr. Ricks, I'd rather not go down that road at this time.
Okay,
no, that's all right. He's one of no integrity and of ill repute, to put it that way. So anyway, this is a good friend of mine that was asked personally by one of the special agents in charge out of the Tulsa office to help them find these guys, and they nailed them. They knew who was involved within. Well, I should say not within 4 hours, but they had a pretty good idea. Within about 3 weeks, they had everybody tagged. And it was the decision of the FBI and the ATF and the NSA and the CIA, and I'm not just spitting this stuff out. I mean, I've seen documents to prove this, that they had to figure out which route they wanted to go on this investigation. It could have gone in a lot of different directions, and it was definitely in overseas connections, both in the Mideast, both the Irish Republican Army, and it's absolutely incredible the amount of people who were involved with this. And they chose to go with two lone nuts, disgruntled ex-army guys that physically, mentally, and financially, they could not have carried this thing off by themselves. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous to even look at it now. And anyway, so what I'm getting at is that there was a conscientious decision to clip it off, nip it at the bud right away.
Well, and you say they knew who these men were. Who were they?
Absolutely. Well, actually, some of them... Some of them were government informants that were paid, and you and I could talk off here on the exact names, and I could tell you the sources and so forth. But some of them are still walking the streets free here in Oklahoma City, in downtown Dublin. I know of one person that lives there, and he's gainfully employed. Some of them were fringe, ex-cons that were informants that. Helped out, and a lot of them really didn't know this was going to carry off. It was just a calamity of errors, and a horrific calamity of errors. And getting back to Deffenbaugh, Mr. Deffenbaugh is not one to be trusted, and I have no problem saying that on the air. He's proven himself many times to completely lie about things. And when he was just point blank asked about information and about facts of the case, telling one thing when he knew something else completely existed. So the New York Times story, as far as Deffenbaugh, and let me give you some advice on that, and if any of your listeners read an article with his name on it, please don't put any credibility or substance to it, because he is one of smoke and mirrors. He is one to conscientiously and willfully lie about the facts of this case, and has done so from the first month that he worked on the case.
Well, you seem to be implying just now that this was some sort of sting operation gone bad.
That's one theory. But one thing that I've learned is that, and let me qualify this situation. I have some very good friends that actually work for the ATF and the FBI, coincidentally in Austin. They're good people. And a lot of the folks in the trenches and the day-to-day, basically the lower line people are very good. It's the leaders, the top leaders at the time within that two-year period after the case, that chose to go the other way, that they shouldn't have gone, that it's been proven that they've lied and done the wrong thing. So I'm not, painting a wide brush over all of FBI or ATF employees. That's not the way to do it. But you have your Mr. Deffenbaugh's, your Mr. March's, your Mr. Rick's, your Louis Freeh's, your Janet Reno's. Those are the people that need to be held accountable for this case. And
well,
for
Go ahead.
For Mr. Deffenbaugh to come now and say, we've got this information, that's complete baloney. He knew of that information. He had it at his desk. He had it at his resources. We're talking the top law enforcement agency in the world. They had the resources of the Saudi, the royal family's personal security service gave him the information. The RCMP out of Ottawa, Scotland Yard out of London, the U.S. Embassy out of Mexico City, the U.S. Embassy out of Russia. There are so many agencies that gave this information to him, and he chose to do nothing about it. So it's really, I don't get upset anymore at Mr. Deffenbaugh. I completely ignore what he has to say because there's no substance to it. There's no credibility. And if he takes exception with that, then I'll sit down with him face-to-face and point it out, and I'll have the committee with me and about 35 people here in Oklahoma City. We'll stand toe-to-toe with him and go through every single point of the case and see if he is willing to explain why he did what he did. So, anyway.
Well, this information that's coming out now, mm-hmm. I believe, is the same kind of thing that was referred to right after they executed Timothy McVeigh. Dan Rather interviewed three FBI agents who
exactly.
said that they had gone and gotten a bunch of information leading to a white supremacist compound in eastern Oklahoma.
Halloween City.
And that their information, now this is after McVeigh was executed, that their information still hadn't been turned over to the defense.
Absolutely.
And this is that same information that we're talking about, is Elohim City,
it's
right?
It's a rehash, yeah. Exactly. And it's the individuals in Elohim City, four of them were actually working for the United States government. And one of them has fled to Ireland. And
who's in Ireland?
Well, Andy Strassmeyer, that was his last whereabouts, from what I understand. And he is a German national, and his dad was well-connected to the Helmut Kohl government at the time.
This is the guy that McVeigh called on his calling card 3 seconds after he rented the Ryder truck over the phone,
yeah.
right?
Now, one thing that we have to remember is you take Timothy McVeigh, you take the single truck bomb made of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil, you take Terry Nichols, you put that whole situation in a box and throw it out the window and start all over again. That's really what you have to do to understand this case, because that was a false flag operation. Whatever was in that truck certainly was ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. I mean, that's ludicrous to even think about that now. And you really have to force yourself, you have to put yourself in a different paradigm, a completely different train of thought to understand what happened here in Oklahoma City. And once you do that, once you're willing to do that, and you set the Danny Deffenbaughs, like I said, and the Bob Ricks and Mr. Marches, you put them in the category where they should be, then you'll start to understand why things happened here in Oklahoma City, why there was a cover-up, why there's such a wide variety, or actually a wider path of the conspiracy and the perpetrators that were involved with this case. So
what we have here, in brief summary, we have a group of white supremacists, and we have foreign involvement, too. Now, are you referring to the Jaina Davis information from News 4 up there about the guys in the brown pickup truck?
Yes. In fact, there were a lot more gentlemen from Middle Eastern descent. Whether or not they were in disguise or whether they're, that's their actual ethnicity, is Mr. Davis has done an incredible job with that, and I give her a lot of credit. I'm not even well-versed in that area, but I understand that they were the majority, they meaning these gentlemen from the Middle East. I'm not sure what countries in particular she has all of that information set out. They were the ones that were actually in charge of this case. The white supremacists were simply it's a false front. They call them lily whites, and they were there on purpose to defray and distract from the actual people behind this operation.
And I read in Stephen Jones' book, McVeigh's lawyer, wrote
yes.
a book where he said that they had sources who were willing to come to the United States and testify that Terry mm-hmm. Nichols was there in bomb-making class with Ramzi Youssef, the guy convicted in the first World Trade Center bombing.
Well, I really don't know. I never followed that lead because there's just so much information here in Oklahoma City, working with the committee and working with the investigators. And, it's amazing when you sit down and you talk to the local policemen, the Oklahoma City Police Department, the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Department, and the Oklahoma State Patrol. They have so much information that points to the Middle Eastern connection. that I never really, you know, the Philippines connection, from what I understand, there's some credibility, but there's not enough to really substantiate it. And even sitting down with Nichols' defense attorneys, they said there's really no truth to that. Now, you know, why they chose to tell me that, I don't know. They may very well be correct, but I didn't have the time to pursue that, so I can't really make a knowledgeable a statement about that.
Well, it can be said, and hopefully it's been revealed to anyone listening, that there's definitely a lot more to this story than we've been being told since 1995.
Absolutely. We have not even begun to scratch the surface, and I'm coming into this after the fact. I only started looking into this in January of 2001. If you can imagine, Charles Key, and I don't know if your listeners are familiar with him. Are they somewhat familiar with Mr. Key?
Well, I've interviewed him on this show.
Good, good. Okay. Charles and I have been good friends now for 2.5 years, and what he had chose to do, giving up his political career, a very successful insurance business, and raising his wife and children, to take on this task, is absolutely incredible. I mean, it's very humbling to, and I'm not trying to put him on a pedestal, but rightfully so, he needs to have a lot of, he deserves a lot of credit for what he did. He was the only person in the State House of Representatives, and nobody in the Senate wouldn't even come close to this case. He asked for just a House subcommittee to reinvestigate this, just completely separate from the federal government. Nobody in the Senate even supported him. None of his colleagues in the House supported him. He had to have three complete strangers from the city say, they step forward and say, hey, we want to help you. And, of course, the report that they put out, coincidentally, 3 weeks before 9/11, it came out. I remember I was on the phone with them trying to help them distribute it with a couple of publishers in the upper Midwest. Anyway, you read that report, and you just sit down and you look at the work that they've done. And to this day, in fact, he was interviewed this morning by a local station saying, Mr. Key, a guy that he, you know, worked with many times on the radio, he says, we finally understand what you've been through. And why it would take 8.5 years? I don't know. It's still going to be a long process to go through. I hope I didn't detract on a tangent there, but...
Well, no, you know, that was great. And I'd like to say that, for my part, I sure appreciate your doggedness on this. The day it happened, I was over at a friend's house, and another friend came over who had been in special forces all through Vietnam for, you mm-hmm. know, had been in the military for 15 years or something. And he took one look at that building and said, a truck bomb didn't do that. They're full of it.
Yeah.
You know, from the very beginning. And so I've been trying to follow this case as best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm really excited to hear that the story's finally breaking out about Elohim City because, you know, the reason they covered up that part is because if you open up the package, you know, it's Pandora's box, and the whole truth starts flowing out.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that Elohim City is, you know, it's not to be completely bonked. There is some substance to it. What that particular area opens up is the informants that the United States government had, both the ATF and the FBI, and they didn't even know about each other.
Right.
And if I take 30 seconds here, I don't want to hold you up. What I found out is that the local FBI office and the office out of Washington weren't speaking with each other, and the same held true with the ATF. So when you have the field offices and the national office not talking to each other, there's something that's bound to happen, and it was tragic. They did not share their information. They didn't even know about each other's informants. How do you expect to, you know, carry out any type of alleged sting operation if that did happen, or try to avoid anything like this if you're not communicating with each other? So
it's funny, though, because they don't seem to have a problem lying.
Oh, no.
They
no,
seem
absolutely
to,
not.
Oh,
no.
Well, golly gee, my phone line reaches right to headquarters to find out what lie I'm supposed to tell the TV man.
Sure. And you know, there are a lot of agents here in town that are very upset about this case today. And I've talked to three of them in the last, 4 months, that they were threatened with their jobs, their pensions, their careers, their health, their welfare. And I'm not exaggerating. It took me a while to really understand the severity of what these guys are up against if they want to come out and tell the truth. Rick Ojeda, who now lives in Georgetown, used to work out of a small office, FBI office just south of here. And he's a very successful, I believe he's still in law. He's practicing in Georgetown, and you may have his phone number. He'd be wanting to get on the radio and an interview about the case. He's excellent. He's one of the few FBI agents that chose In fact, I think he was interviewed by Dan Rather.
Yeah,
he was one of those.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to get his number from you. That'd be a great interview.
That's great. I wouldn't mind. We'll do that off the air. In fact, I've got it here. So
great. Yeah, we'll have to get to that. I'm sorry, we're all out of time for the weekend interview show. I'd like to give you an opportunity to say any last words you have, and I'd like to real quick before that give out a couple of websites. If people go to thenewamerican.com, they have an archive on Oklahoma City that's incredible, and also WorldNet Daily also has an Oklahoma City bombing archive that is definitely worth looking at.
May I give the bombing committee's website?
Please do.
It's www.okcbombing, all one word, okcbombing.org.
Now, I got to tell you, I tried to go to that site yesterday, and it said page cannot be displayed. You guys having problems with your server or something?
Well, not that I'm aware of. Charles is still administrating it out of his home. They had to close the office, gosh, I think it was November of 2002.
Okay, well, I'll make sure to try again on that. That's okcbombing.org.
Yes, that is correct. And, you know, the four gentlemen on there, I'm a volunteer with the committee. Like I said, I came in late in the game, but I'm trying to do what I can to help them out. So if any financial donations are available, by all means, you know, they're welcome to help out. This is an incredible case, and it's not going to rest. It's not going to go away. And there's a lot of people here, survivors, victims, family members, that are absolutely furious at the way it's been handled. And hopefully, with the trial in McAllister, it'll bring out a larger measure of truth than was ever imagined could be done in Denver. So I don't want to hold you up anymore. I know you're about ready to wrap up your show here.
All right. Well, so. I sure appreciate you sticking to this case and working as hard on it as you have been. And hopefully we'll be back in contact around the time the Nichols trial starts.
Thank you, Phil.
Maybe
and, you can call me back from Mr. Ojeda's phone number at another time if you'd like.
I sure will.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mr. Emery.
All right. Have a good evening.
All right.
Bye-bye.
The victims of the Oklahoma City bombing have been given not vengeance, but justice. Due process ruled. The case was proved. The verdict was calmly reached. And the rights of the accused were protected and observed to the full and to the end. Under the laws of our country, the matter is concluded. Life and history bring tragedies, and often they cannot be explained.
With regard to this proceeding, basically, there are four elements that I have to receive information regarding.
CBS News poll out this morning finds 53% of Americans believe questions about what happened in Oklahoma City will continue.
Based on a sketch of two men believed to be the bombers. One sketch showed a dead ringer for Timothy McVeigh, but John Doe number two, according to the FBI, turned out not to exist. So authorities focused their attention on Timothy McVeigh, who was charged with the crime just 2 days after the bombing.
Kathy, I know you have been so concerned about this execution because you spent the recent years of your life looking into whether or not there was a conspiracy that was larger than just McVeigh, Terry Nichols, and a couple of others. Do you feel any differently now having seen this or having gone through the execution this morning?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, this was just a bump in the road on... Just a bump in the road to me. I feel absolutely no different. There absolutely were other people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing, and I've been working with MGA Films the last 2 years, and we're going to be releasing a documentary entitled A Cry for Justice, The Untold Story, and I think the American people are going to be surprised at what they're going to see.
Oh, my God, another bomb.
They were reports I have is that one device was deactivated. Apparently there's another device, and obviously whatever did the damage to the Murrah building was a tremendous, very sophisticated explosive device. So
let's take a look now, if we could. I understand we just received videotape in a news conference held just a few moments ago at St. Anthony's Hospital.
Okay. This is Tom Coniglione. He's medical director of St. Anthony Hospital. This is Jim Maravich. He is chief operating officer and executive vice president of the hospital. I'll give you their cards after the conference is over so you'll know the spelling.
We've got an ambulance going in.
Doctor, can you tell us the situation?
The situation at the present time is that we have treated more than 56 injuries. There have been several more since last count. At the present time, the medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area. I've been told by the police department that just as soon as those bombs are defused, they will permit the medical teams to enter. Then once the medical teams enter, we expect quite a large number of rather badly injured individuals being brought here.
Update our audience that the Justice Department is reporting that a second explosive device has been found in the AP Murrah building in downtown Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. Mike, you're still with us, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And I might tell you in addition to that in fact what we were told at the scene a few minutes ago was that in fact two different explosive devices were found in addition to the one that went off.
So a total of three.
Of three, and of course then there was mass confusion whenever there were hundreds of spectators in the area, and when they heard that there were other bombs in the building, people were running from the area in the opposite direction as fast as they could, trying to evacuate again.
So if you weren't under that desk, you wouldn't have made it.
Well, my floor was okay, and the ceiling had come down, but there was still concrete above, so it was just a corner of the office that was left that we were in. Everybody else that we worked with is gone.
Are you okay? Just the corner of your office was okay, and the rest of the floor was completely flattened?
We could go over the edge and look, and you could see the sky and as far down as you can look, and just a hole.
And which floor were you on?
Fifth. Fifth floor.
Just the one corner of the fifth floor wasn't completely flattened.
I don't know what the west end of the building looks like.
Did everybody just
crawl
out of the desk?
It was like slow motion. We crawled under before the glass part was coming, and everything it just seemed to roll in on us. I thought it was an earthquake when it started. It was just a kind of a shake, and then everything started going like this, and I dove under the desk, and then all the glass came in, and the ceilings came down. I probably got cut worse if I hadn't been under the desk. I just got little scrapes and scratches. I was really lucky.
Really lucky.
Now, we're also hearing from some witnesses on the scene that they've overheard from firefighters that were first on the scene that there was a possibility that there was a secondary explosive device besides the car bomb device outside the building, and that device may have been placed near the nursery.
With 168 people killed in the blast, the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City 3 years ago was the most heinous crime in United States history. Tonight, Timothy McVeigh speaks publicly for the first time since he was convicted and sentenced to death for setting the explosion.
What was your reaction when you saw those pictures? What was that like for you that day? People were shouting at you. I remember somebody had shouted out, baby killer. In your high school yearbook, under future plans, you wrote, and I'm quoting here,
okay,
"Take it as it comes, buy a Lamborghini, California girls."
They say, "Well, Tim, if we think you're guilty, imagine the paradox. In the Gulf War, you were given medals for killing people."
Sounds like you were pretty angry when you came back. Tell me what it is about that shootout at Ruby Ridge that concerned you. There are a lot of people who are upset by that, who would say, yeah, what happened there is wrong, but those are isolated incidents. That was just Ruby Ridge and Waco. What would you say to that?
And according to Timothy McVeigh, it is up to the citizens of the United States to keep their government in check.
He's the Oklahoma City bomber, and there's no doubt about it in my mind.
I'm sure that there would be someone who would step forward with an alibi. I was waiting for the day that someone said, hey, wait a minute, I saw him here, there, or wherever. And it never happened.
I mean, you realize that most people in this country think you're responsible for the bombing, correct?
Correct.
Right. So if your perception is that you didn't get a fair trial, they're saying, so what?
Timothy McVeigh's trial included hours of wrenching testimony from victims describing the carnage after the explosion.
Did you ever talk to Kaczynski?
I did.
Do you think that you and he share similar concerns about how the government operates these days? Let me ask you your opinion, just a snapshot opinion of some of the institutions in this country and some officials in this country. ATF, for example, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau. The IRS? FBI? What do you think of the Attorney General, Jan Arena? President Clinton?
Timothy McVeigh says he has little faith that the judicial system will grant him a new trial.
Are you prepared for death?
Agents forewarned about a bomb in Oklahoma City. Did they know the Murrah building was a target? The ATF says no, absolutely not. But tonight in the story you'll see only on the news channel, you're about to hear otherwise from people who were at the Murrah building that morning.
We asked some simple questions and we can't get any answers, so it makes us that much more curious, you know. Where the hell were they?
The news channel did ask for a private meeting with ATF officials to discuss the credibility of these witness reports, but the ATF refused, saying they had no more to say on the subject.
What he told him is that he thought that they had received a tip that morning of the bomb.
Yet another witness, a rescue worker, says after she talked with an agent at the bombing scene, she also suspected the ATF was warned and agents stayed away from their office that morning.
I asked him if his office was in the building, and he said yes, and I asked if there were any ATF agents that were still in the building, and he said no, we weren't here.
Witness number one approached an ATF agent nearby. He claims he asked the agent what had happened, and witness number one says this is what the agent told him.
He started getting a little bit nervous. He tried reaching somebody on a two-way radio. Couldn't get anybody, and I told him I wanted an answer right then. He said they were in the briefing. None of the agents had been in there. They had been tipped by their pagers not to come into work that day. Plain as day out of his mouth. They were tipped. Why wasn't anybody else? There was a lot of people, good people, died down there. And if they knew, they should have let everybody else know.
But there were more bombs set to go off, according to ATF officials.
It's been about 5 hours now since that first explosion occurred, almost 5 hours exactly. You probably, if you were in bed at the time that it rattled you around, you looked at the alarm clock, you'll remember the time, and you will certainly now remember April 19th, 1995. But 5 hours since, and because of these renewed concerns about new devices, 5 hours in, they are still really not able to get the rescue effort into full swing.
I just took a look down the street at the Murrah building again. I see another bomb truck going, so apparently they're going to try to get out that third bomb that's been talked about.
Freedom is the freedom to say 2 + 2 = 4. How many fingers am I holding up, miss?
Four.
And if the party says there are not four, but five, then how many?
Five.
The government didn't do a good job of proving that Terry Nichols was greatly involved in all of this.